May it please the court.
You may proceed.
My name is Tom Henderson. I represent Megan Garland. She's the appellant here. Ms. Garland came to my office several years ago with a problem. She had an administrative order in her hand that she had gotten on her own from the Family Support Division, and it had it was basically just chock full of errors. It had misspelled parties' names, which is probably not that important, but in our position is it didn't follow Form 14 even closely at all. And it also ordered the Division of Vital Records to name the father as the mother on the birth certificate. That case started out by the division filing issuing a notice and finding a financial responsibility to the father. He then requested an administrative hearing. After the hearing, they lowered the amount from what was in their initial finding from $558 to I think $357. So when Ms. Garland got to my office, I looked at this administrative order. I noticed that it was full of errors. For whatever reason, I was aware of some of the case law, Washington v. Jones in particular, and told her that while she'd have to pay me, there may be some subsidy in the form of us recovering some attorney's fees because the error was so messed up, the order was so messed up. So we filed, at that point we had a choice. We could have filed a paternity action, or there was a number of ways to correct the child support error. We chose petition for review because that would allow us to recover our fees. So we thought. We got to court. It was pretty non-confrontational. I explained to the father where the errors had been made and showed him if you did the form the right way, what it would come up to. We thought it was around $778. Reached a settlement of $500.
What role did the state have that you are challenging that was adverse to your client?
The issuance of the administrative order.
So it was the adjudication is what you claim was adverse to your client.
That's correct.
And are there cases that, I mean, the statute appears to, the purpose of the statute is to cause the state to be cautious in the positions it takes when it is filing a proceeding or defending a proceeding. And that isn't the nature of the state action that you are challenging as your basis to collect fees.
Well, I think that the division has been charged with a very important responsibility of fairly adjudicating the child support between parties. The whole point of it is that they can get an inexpensive.
But they were more than an arbitrator determiner at the administrative level, though, weren't they? They actually were a party to the circuit court case.
Well,
and they filed a motion to dismiss.
They entered at the circuit court level.
So but who did you sue at the circuit court level?
We sued the father, in spirit, but we basically sued the family
support
division.
At the administrative level, the state was representing your client.
It's a little confusing as to how it all, what the posture of everything is. The state and my understanding is they issue the notice of finding. They're really prosecuting the case against the father.
Your client.
Right. And she's entered as a party. If you look at the administrative pleadings, she's there. She has to appear at the hearing, I believe, in order to put in her evidence. So basically, we get to the circuit court and let the judge know there that we had reached an amicable resolution, and the attorney for the Family Support Division didn't want to sign the papers, but also didn't present any objection, and I guess the trial court not seeing any real issue.
And what if they had? Did they have a right to object to the settlement?
Certainly, they could have. The posture of the case was a review of the administrative order, and if they wanted to defend their action at the agency level, they had every right to do that.
Because, I think the issue seems to be this is not something where they paid someone benefits and they're seeking to recover them from the other spouse. You all came in and said, hey, we're having this disagreement about child support, please resolve it. And they say it's unfair for them to then be treated like a party and have to pay attorney's fees if their resolution was not substantially justified because they're really the arbiter, not the party, and yet they are they are a party in the circuit court. So it's kind of a...
Well, they're the arbiter, but they're also the, for lack of a better term, the prosecutor of the case against the father. And I think the division has been charged with the responsibility to fairly adjudicate these child support amounts between the parties. She, the mother here, had a right under Form 14. There's a formula to a certain amount of child support.
But if what if a trial court messes up the Form 40 and it goes up an appeal and gets reversed? Do we make the trial court pay attorney's fees?
No, because they're not an administrative agency. This is a purely about right. agency law, and the Greenbrier case has said that the purpose of this attorney fee statute is to encourage these agencies to carefully scrutinize the decisions they're making.
But isn't it, and that's not what the statute says. The statute says, finds that the position of the state was substantially justified. And all through your brief, instead of position, you have substituted the word decision. And that's a significant difference, isn't it? That it does not appear that the statutes were intended to award attorney's fees anytime there is an adverse decision made by an administrative tribunal. Isn't it intended only when the state is defending or prosecuting as a party in an administrative proceeding rather than the decision maker in the administrative proceeding?
Well, I think they were a party. They do prosecute the case, and the...
Did they take a position contrary to your client in prosecuting the case?
They took the position. They also adjudicate. They're also in charge of the hearing.
Correct.
So they changed their mind, I guess you would say, that the director initially...
They have two roles. The state has two roles.
Right. So I think the director initially issued the findings of fact or findings of financial responsibility at around 558. And then for whatever reason, the person who was doing the hearing, and that would have been enforceable, by the way, if nobody had done anything. It's immediately enforceable, even while the agency proceeding is going on. But for whatever reason, the person doing the hearing thought it should be lower. That position is what we think is, you know, not substantially justified. Which I would also add is not really an issue before the court today. We're asking you to remand this back to the trial court for a determination of whether it was substantially justified.
And my question is, are there cases where attorney's fees have been awarded because of a decision made by an administrative tribunal as the unreasonable position of the state?
Well, I believe Washington v. Jones is extremely, it starts at the beginning, and the respondent has brought up some new arguments to this court that was never been brought up until their brief in this court. It was not at the Court of Appeals, that they bring up some a new argument that this wasn't even an agency proceeding under 536.085, I believe it is. But if you look at Washington v. Jones, and I know that's an Eastern District case, it starts out with an analysis.
But it may not be an argument for a substitute brief, but 84.04 does allow for, if you raise an issue on rebuttal, in response, that the appellant can respond to it.
I read the rule closely as I could, and I determined that no one is supposed to be changing the basis of their brief.
But 8404, although it's not a substitute brief, does allow you to, as the appellant, to respond to a respondent's position.
8404?
8404.
I'll have to have a look at that rule. But
it's right next to the other one.
I think what you're saying is, what Judge Heidelman's saying is you can support the trial court judgment on any basis that's justified in the record. It's not like you have to preserve issues as a respondent. That's the more general point.
Be that as it may, I still think that Washington v. Jones analyzed that, and we followed that case. I think it would be...
And what did it say that's relevant here?
It determined that it was an agency proceeding, and it analyzed 536.085. It didn't mention the particular clause that they're pointing to, but it was the very next sentence. I think it would be hard to believe that the Court of Appeals And this court denied transfer on the case, so it was...
And did it grant attorney's fees in that?
It did grant attorney's fees.
Was it a case where the agency had sought reimbursement for child support and it paid, or was it a case like this where the parties...
It was a case where the father, I think it was a modification, so they were increasing the child support against the father. He was the person who filed the petition for review in that case.
And to provide the attorney's fees, doesn't the circuit court have to... find it was substantially unjustified?
They do. And I think that issue hasn't been reached because of what happened at the trial court. They essentially dismissed my petition for attorney's fees on the basis that my client wasn't a prevailing party.
Did you prevail on the petition for judicial review?
Yes, Your Honor.
How did you do that?
Because we have a more favorable child support order than we had whenever we left the...
Did the trial court give that to you?
The trial court did. It was an order entered by the trial court. The fact that we had agreed, and the trial court apparently saw no need for a hearing. The division didn't object. An order is an order, no matter how it, you know, whether it's by consent or not, it's still...
It's signed by the judge.
It's signed by the judge. And not only that, it's Judge Gertner brought up at the Court of Appeals that he thought it wasn't of much benefit because of the shift in insurance responsibility. But the fact of the matter, in this case, it says that the father had to pay the insurance only if it was available to him through a group plan. Well, it wasn't in this case, and I know that that's not part of the record. But Mama had been paying it all along, so it was to her benefit to have him pay more money and less insurance, and that's how we resolved this case. I see that my time is...
Clearly, your client benefited from your counsel.
I'm sorry?
Clearly, your client benefited from your counsel.
I believe she did, yes.
I have one further question. Your opponent talks about the definition of agency proceeding in the statute, and an agency proceeding does not include proceedings for determining the eligibility or entitlement of an individual to a monetary benefit or its equivalent child custody proceedings, nor proceedings to establish fix a rate. So why doesn't that... disallow attorney fees in this case for you?
Well, there's no cases on this, and there's what I was touching on earlier. The Court of Appeals analyzed the statute.
So other than Washington versus Jones, do you have any of the authority for the interpretation of this provision?
Well, Washington v. Jones relies on some other cases, Hernandez. There's some cases out of the Western District. There's a number of cases where family support division has been ordered to pay fees. And
should this court decide that issue is before us, though, and of course we're not bound by the Court of Appeals decisions, can you tell us, is a policy matter or is it a statutory interpretation matter, why this is an agency proceeding given that language?
Yes, I think that entitlement to a benefit in all the cases, the line of cases cited by the respondent, if you look, they are Medicaid cases, so it's a benefit from the state. Well, I don't think that this is encompassed by that clause at all. I think that what this is an adjudication of the father's liability, not a benefit to the mother. The mother was entitled to the support by statute. It's not a determination of whether a child who has separate parents is entitled to it.
But the difference is, in these other cases, the state is giving or not giving benefits. And in this case, the state is arbitrating who should get what size of the benefits.
I don't believe Washington v. Jones was a temporary assistance case. I don't believe it was.
Thank you, Counselor. You'll have some time on rebuttal.
May it please the Court.
You may proceed.
Let me turn first to Greenbrier itself, because this case is actually the first time, so far as we know, that this Court has been presented with a case in which there was a settlement and someone claimed that the settlement constituted prevailing in a proceeding. In Greenbrier, there is a reference to settlements being prevailing. That, however, is dicta. It wasn't a settlement case. The court referred solely as precedent to White versus Veterinary Board, a case before the Western District. But the question of settlement was dicta in that case as well. In White, the court referred to the Texas State Teachers case, the United States Supreme Court case, and said that the touchstone of the prevailing party inquiry must be the material alteration of the legal relationship of the parties. The actual quote from Texas State Teachers is, it changes the legal relationship between itself and the defendant. The White language...
Can't you be a prevailing party under federal law if you settle?
Yes. So long as there is a material alteration of the legal relationship between the parties.
But that's a different question. You're trying to get a, I mean, it seems like you're trying to argue that settlements can never justify.
No, and let me take the Leilani case that you just heard as the example. In that case, if there were a settlement, it would be a settlement between the Director of Revenue and Leilani, who Mr. Hirth pointed out, owes the tax. That would be a settlement that changed the legal relationship between the Director of Revenue and Leilani. But in this case, there was no change because there was no legal relationship.
Well, once the administrative agency issued their order for 300 and for a
yes.
certain amount of child support, could they bring an action to enforce that amount?
They don't do that. That isn't the way the system works. And maybe it's worth going back to this whole concept of the 4D program. The federal government initiated the 4D program, and it is a grant program from the federal government that Missouri has decided to participate in. Our commitment to the federal government is to create an administrative system in which someone can, in a cheaper, faster, easier way, address child support issues. So, for example, when Mother came to the department or to the division and asked for help, there wasn't a docket fee charge. She could have gone to circuit court and asked for exactly the same thing, but she would have paid the docket fee. If she'd gone to circuit court, she would have had the obligation to do discovery to find the information and present it to the judge. But in the 4D program, the division does that work. It finds the information about both parents and presents it to the hearing officer.
Say it was father who was the respondent, had not sought assistance.
Yes.
And the division found that father owed lots and lots of child support.
In response to something that mother filed?
This kind of fact situation here.
Okay, so mother filed, okay. The father
say it's father seeking attorney's
yes.
fees here, for instance.
Yes.
The father had done better in the circuit court. My point is, you're saying they can never owe attorney's fees, but what about a situation where, not that it would occur, but if the agency were to issue an order that was simply totally unjustified by the record, that had no basis in fact, or held someone who was not the father, something that was just outrageous. They would have no remedy here, and yet they hadn't even been the one who asked for. They would end up having to pay fees to appeal an order that they had no part in seeking. And I understand that may just be the way it is, but why wouldn't that be the kind of situation that the prevailing party rules are intended to address to protect that party from having to incur fees to overturn something that's not substantially justified?
Well, it would be the same as suing the AHC and getting fees from the AHC if you disagreed with an AHC position. I mean, the system is not going to be, I guess, entirely equitable to everyone all the time. We do the best we can, and we set it up in a way that says that we're going to do as much as we can on the administrative side. The mother here, after she filed, actually didn't have to show up at the hearing. The department just does the best it can with the information that it derives and tries to come up with a decision that would establish.
And that decision is enforceable. The 337, they could get it enforced.
Yes, unlike a modification of a court order, which can also begin in this 4D process, that has to go to court, so there is a modification. But here there actually is an administrative order which is enforceable until such time as the circuit court changes it or supersedes it, which in this instance happened as a result of a petition for review filed in the Associate Circuit Court. But it could easily happen, as counsel said, by the mother having gone into circuit court and initiated her own proceeding.
What if someone had not paid here? No one had appealed what
yes.
the agency did, and then a year later no payments had been made as
yes.
required. Does the agency have any further involvement? How is that decision?
Well, generally the agency is most active if there is a temporary aid to needy families, TANF payments, and there are hundreds or thousands of those every year.
And then, right. Does the mother go into court to enforce the right, or does she have to ask the agency to do that?
The prosecutors.
She could do either one.
Either one, I believe. And I don't know how often the agency goes into court. I mean, frankly, there was a question earlier about who the parties are when you're in circuit court. And unlike you know, the AHC. We give the AHC notice in the revenue cases, but we don't name them as a party. In this instance, we name them as a party. Their role in the court is frankly somewhat ambiguous, although their object is to reach a decision expeditiously that helps the parents the best they can. And in fact, here you have an odd thing that happened, that the father and the mother reached a decision, and then if you read through the briefs in the legal file, you'll see that what happened next was that the Assistant Attorney General, Ms. Weider Hatfield, actually drafted an order because that would help this move along. It's not precisely the order that Mr. Henderson presented to the court after she sent it to him. But the object here was to get this thing resolved, because that's part of the purpose of the 4D program, is to get things resolved as quickly and as cheaply as we can.
If I may have the wrong program, under 4D, don't the prosecutors pursue it and get a percentage of the fee as part of the...
There are instances where prosecutors handle 4D matters, yes, and they are given compensation for that, yes.
Mr. Layton, if one reads the statute that is the basis for an entitlement to attorney's fees, the statute can be read, I believe, to indicate that attorney's fees are only allowed to a party who the state has taken a position against them. I don't read the statute as ever allowing attorney's fees, because there may be some mistake in an adjudication, so that because an administrative agency made a wrong adjudication, the state is obligated to pay attorney's fees. Because it talks about a party prevailing in the proceeding brought by or against the state. It doesn't talk about adjudicated
right
by the state.
And actually, this case presents we'll modify the facts slightly and give a hypothetical of where the result of the Eastern District leads. Let's suppose that the only thing that Ms. Garland found wrong with the agency adjudication was the obvious Scrivener's error in saying that the father's name should be listed as the mother on the birth certificate. She didn't take that back to the division and say, would you correct this? If Mr. Henderson's right, under his theory, he can go into circuit court and get that changed, that obvious error changed, and then he gets attorney's fees all the way back through if he actually was involved in the administrative proceeding. And on what basis?
It appears from reading the statute that mother in this proceeding could never get attorney's fees, because the state in the proceedings was assisting her in accomplishing her purpose, and then in its a different role adjudicating it. That it never brought a proceeding against her,
right,
or it never, she didn't bring one against the state, or the state didn't bring one against her. So under the statute, she would never be entitled to attorney's fees.
No, and that of course assumes that this isn't a I wrote this on the wrong page, said that this isn't a monetary benefit, which excludes this at all.
Even if it doesn't, the basic language of the statute appears only to permit attorney's fees. And when you look at the case law as to what the purpose of the statute is, the purpose is to make the state understand if it takes an unreasonable position in either filing a proceeding or defending a proceeding, then it can be liable for attorney's
fees. Right, and I don't think you have to address in this circumstance what happens if the agency lawyer did come into circuit court and make an argument that both father and mother are wrong and you shouldn't take the $500 a month and something like that, because that isn't what happened here. The agency never took any position in the circuit court, which is fairly typical.
Would it be a different situation if the agency had paid out assistance, TANF, or other assistance, and then sought reimbursement?
Yes, yes. Because
even
at
though
that
they're
point,
still in a dual role there, they're the arbiter.
Yes, but at that point, then we're taking a position. The position to be evaluated there would not be the position of the adjudication. It would be the position that the state takes with regard to the state debt.
Because they're a plaintiff or defendant in that case.
Their role there is a very different one than we have here.
The trial court believed it entered a superseding order.
Yes.
Not granting the petition for review.
Yes, it's phrased that way. The court in its docket entry said that the petition for the agency decision had been abandoned. And the statute specifically refers to the ability of a trial court to supersede any of these orders, either at the time at the outset as happened in this instance, or a month or a year or 5 years later.
It's 454.501. Do you know whether the amount of the administrative order, the arrearage that accumulated under that was still owed?
It probably was. The way I read the order, the judge excuses the arrearage, and I'm sure Mr. Henderson would know better than I. And the agency did not take a position on that in the circuit court.
That's different than if it had reversed or determined there had been error, that the prior adjudication had been flawed, and it entered an order that would be effective ab initio.
Yes.
There would be nothing to excuse.
There would be nothing to excuse. I think that's right. Just a quick reference with regard to the issue that we allegedly added to the case, which to a certain extent is true. That's not an issue that we've raised elsewhere. I think, as Judge Stiff pointed out, there's no obligation on respondent to preserve issues. We felt like we had an obligation to articulate this because it is the court's right to look at the statute and say, this case shouldn't be here anyway, and so we addressed it. But let me make an observation about two observations about that. One is the fact that in prior cases the state has not raised that claim doesn't mean that it shouldn't have been raised in those prior cases. It just means that in Washington and these other cases it wasn't raised and wasn't addressed. But second, there's a bit of irony in the argument that Mr. Henderson made this morning. He wants you to take the provision about what it means to get a benefit and draw that really narrowly and say, well, that only applies when you're asking for a benefit from the state. And then he wants you to turn around and say, but I can prevail even though I prevail against someone other than the state. I don't think you can do it that way. In this instance, it's our view that this statute was not designed, in fact, it was expressly intended not to reach cases in which individuals come to court because they have an argument between each other, between a father and a mother. The state has done its best to help with that outside of the judicial process. It doesn't seem to have worked. They work things out, and having worked things out, they walk away from what the state did. That is their right, but they're not entitled to have the state pay the cost of doing that.
Mr. Layton, in looking at subparagraph 2 of 536.087, it talks about that you award reasonable fees and expenses to a party who prevails in any action for judicial review. And when you're looking at whether the position of the state was substantially justified, it actually says, unless the court finds that during such agency proceeding, the position of the state was substantially justified. So it does not talk, you mentioned whether or not the state's position in the judicial review proceeding could subject it to being unreasonable. But the statute limits the conduct that you look at to the agency's position during the agency proceeding.
Right, and my thought was that there can be a TANF that can be addressed in the administrative proceeding as well, and the agency may take an affirmative position in the adjudication with regard to TANF.
But that also would cause it to exclude what the agency did in adjudicating
yes.
the proceeding, because that wouldn't be their position during the agency
right.
proceeding.
The object is to go back to the original decision by the agency, like the decision of the Director of Revenue. It's not to go back to the decision of the AHC or the decision of the hearing officer adjudicating a dispute between father and mother.
Or the position that the state took during judicial review.
even though here there was no such position.
Right. You know, it's interesting that you use the terminology they, even though here it's only the wife who's suing for attorney's fees. So it's your position that neither one of them
Position that neither one could, and as Judge Gardner pointed out, if the alternative is possible, there's an argument here for the father as well, but he didn't have an attorney. He didn't appear with an attorney, so he wouldn't have a claim. But in a similar case, if a father did have an attorney, the father could claim, well, I came out ahead on this deal, and so I should be able to get fees as well.
It's your position that he couldn't either.
Our position is that he couldn't in any event.
Even though it was initiated against him. That's not the question here.
Right. Interesting. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, counsel.
Now, let me clarify the excellent point by Judge Wilson. There was you filed a petition for review, but the drafting of the settlement had a superseding order that dismissed the petition for review. So what happened was basically a settlement between the husband and wife, and a petition review did not survive that settlement. Is that correct?
That's what the dismissal order of my application said. But as we brought up in the brief, that's not necessarily what the judgment said the day that the judge signed the order changing the child support amount. It didn't say we're superseding this or following some other statute. But yes, it is written into the form language that was provided for the judge dismissing my application for attorney's fees. I don't think it's relevant. If you look at, the Washington v. Jones case,
point is you're trying to prevail on the petition for review of the agency proceeding. If there's no petition review anymore in the settlement, then that's not it's just basically a settlement between the husband and wife.
Your Honor, the statute itself says that you can prevail when you obtain a favorable order, decision, judgment, or even a dismissal. That's the language of the statute. So you don't have to have said that, you don't have to go through the colloquy of that it was arbitrary and capricious or any of that. It doesn't have to be findings like that. You can win with a dismissal.
Do you believe that the change in the child support amount was retroactive to the original administrative order?
I can't answer that standing here. I can't remember how we did that. I'm assuming that whatever we did, we probably said to Dad, this will be from this day forward. A lot of it is you say you do what you can just to get the thing settled because we're tired of coming to court, just a couple court appearances. I would point out that I think that the position of the state is the decision of the state. We are appealing the administrative order.
And how do you reconcile that with saying the court shall include in that reasonable attorney's fees incurred in looking at whether it is the state's position was substantially justified? It limits the court to looking at the position of the state during such agency proceeding.
And I believe that the order that came out of the agency proceeding is the position of the state.
But the state was not a party there. They were the arbiter of the...
They're both the prosecutor.
But the position would be, they were prosecutor, and so it would be their position as prosecutor, not their position as adjudicator.
It's the same... person. I mean, it's a dual role.
What amount did the Form 14 that was offered by the mother indicate at the administrative
hearing? What was done in the financial responsibility was $558, and so that, I guess that was offered on the mother's behalf by the.
So the position of the agency was $558, which is $50 more than what you eventually settled for.
It was initially, but the hearing officer changed the position of the state. So we're alleging that the decision out of the agency is the position of the state, that's what we had to change. That's what caused mother to be accused.
Is a fair reading of the statute that the position was taken, was that the evidence that they offered or the order that they tried to obtain as opposed to the one that was actually given?
That could all be true. And I think that this highlights the problem here is we're trying to get out of paying attorney's fees by arguing, one, it was prevailing party or it wasn't an agency proceeding. The trial court never got into these issues of whether it was substantially justified or whatever. They decided it on another basis. I think that this court should send it back for determination of whether it was substantially justified.
Did the agency justify the 337? How did the agency justify the 337 versus the 500-something?
They had made some errors, I believe, in the income, and they put messed up who was paying for the insurance. There was one of the parents had other children that they paid support on. It was just a bunch of errors like that. If you fiddle with the numbers on 4 and 14 very long, you can make quite a difference.
No further questions.